pretty monarch butterflies are in trouble. Some say they should be protected as an endangered species, but other butterfly lovers say no way.
Simply because this would mean regulation, and people don't want regulation.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the fight over how to save an iconic butterfly. Also, a beekeeper suspects pesticides poisoned her bees.
There's certain levels that the EPA considers toxic to bees, and ours was on the lower side.
But her bees died anyway, and now she's looking to science for answers. All that and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Carbon dioxide emissions have a pretty bad rap these days, with good reason. CO2 is the number one cause of global warming. And right now, the dirtiest fuel, coal, still supplies nearly 40% of the electricity in the U.S., and even more in many developing countries. But CO2 can actually be useful as a building block to make all sorts of everyday products. Inside Energy's Lee Patterson has more on the race to capture and use carbon before it gets into the atmosphere.
The state of Wyoming is heavily dependent on coal, and so it's investing $15 million to build a carbon testing lab called the Integrated Test Center. Its first tenant,
the $20 million Carbon X Prize, Reimagine CO2.
Reimagine CO2 as sunglasses, a bicycle, or a pair of sneakers.
Like building materials, low-emission fuels, and other items that we use every day.
That's the big vision behind the Carbon X Prize. Take the carbon right out of harmful emissions and put it to use. The competition launched in September and is sponsored by U.S. energy giant NRG Energy and Canada's Oil Sands Innovation Alliance. Pressure is building worldwide to deal with emissions. Researchers all over the country are working on using carbon, as is the Department of Energy in collaboration with China. In Wyoming, the stakes are huge. Here's Governor Matt Mead talking about the Integrated Test Center.
I can't wait to see what great minds come up with to reimagine CO2. I believe the innovations will be breathtaking and make a profound difference in the future of coal.
There's a technical term for all of those innovations.
In this building, we mainly talk about CO2 capture and CO2 utilization.
CO2 utilization. Dr. Mao Hong Fan is a professor of chemical and petroleum engineering at the University of Wyoming. He shows me around the chemical and fuel labs and introduces me to some of his students.
My name is Anthony Richard. I primarily focus on the conversion of CO2 and hydrogen into methanol.
It's used to make all kinds of products.
From, let's say, paints and plastics to other types of chemicals.
And when it's used in a process like this to make methanol, that CO2 isn't released into the atmosphere. And also,
not giving away something that we can then convert into a product that has value.
Products like carbon fiber, cement, plastics, fertilizer, dry ice, and even carbonation in soft drinks. Captured CO2 can also be pumped underground to get more oil out. But the aim of this research goes way beyond the novelty of carbonating your Coke. The holy grail is finding a way to pay for carbon capture. That's the technology that removes emissions right out of the smokestack. But it's expensive, and ironically, uses a lot of energy in the process. Simon Bennett, an analyst with the International Energy Agency, says offsetting those costs with carbon products is a seductive option.
Technology gets provided, consumerism will do the rest, and that's a very, very attractive thing.
But, Bennett points out,
the willingness to pay for CO2 to use it in industry is not really stacking up in the current market context.
According to the IEA, the industrial market for captured CO2 is around 200 million tons per year. Compare that to CO2 emissions from energy use in 2013, about 35 billion tons. Despite these odds, coal-dependent economies all over the world are banking on low-carbon technology. Mark Northam is the director of the University of Wyoming School of Energy Resources. He describes the odd pair of twin goals, combating climate change while also keeping coal on the market.
The real fly in the ointment is the technology gap between our desire to do that and our ability to do that.
But bridging that gap will take time, money, and government support. Three huge obstacles to disrupting the advance of climate change. For Inside Energy, I'm Lee Patterson.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Our Future of Coal series also looks at what's in store for coal. You can find all of those stories at our website, AlleghenyFront.org.
This is Reed Frazier, reporter for the Allegheny Front, and I have an important announcement to make. Over the last few weeks, you might have noticed something different about us. No, we haven't been working out. And no, this tattoo, we got that years ago. We have a new website. Same address, AlleghenyFront.org, but it looks a lot different. It's got lots of photos, videos, and special sections. Of course, it is a work in progress, and we'd love your feedback. You can find us in all the usual places, on Facebook, on Twitter, at Allegheny Front, or good old-fashioned email, info@AlleghenyFront.org. Hope to see you online.
Pennsylvania is one step closer to new rules for the oil and gas industry. This week, the Environmental Quality Board approved a slate of new regulations the Wolf administration says will protect public health and the environment. The drilling boom has led to increased attention from the oil and gas industry into how Pennsylvania writes and enforces environmental regulations. So the industry has hired many former state officials to work and lobby for them. It's often called the revolving door between private industries and the public agencies that oversee them. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has compiled an interactive online archive of nearly 40 people who switched sides like this, sometimes more than once in the last decade. It's called Blurred Lines, and I spoke with her about why she's looking at this phenomenon now.
As a reporter here in Harrisburg, I notice that with the change in administrations, a lot of the people who were perhaps sitting up next to the secretary of the department during budget hearings moved to the back of the room as a lobbyist between the Corbett and the Wolf administrations. And then I've also noticed a lot of the people from the Rendell administration cycled back into the Wolf administration. So you hear about the revolving door a lot, but I just thought this could be an interesting way to showcase it to the public in a visual way, to let them see it. So I included close to 40 people from three administrations, Rendell, Corbett, and Wolf. I just went back in time to the Rendell era because that's sort of when the Marcellus boom took off, and there's been a lot of engagement from both the energy industry and environmental groups around that issue.
I enjoyed perusing it and clicking on the dates, and it's kind of almost like Tetris. It's kind of satisfying to see the to see the boxes move from side to side, but you can also click on the person's face and sort of get a closer view of what their experience is.
Right, and I have to give credit for our very talented graphics guy here at WITF, Tom Downing. He did a great job creating that design. And yeah, I hadn't heard Tetris, but I think it sort of looks like a little square dance as you click down the years of the movements.
And there are some names here that a lot of Pennsylvanians will recognize. Former Governor Rendell himself, who's a Democrat. Katie McGinty, who is running for U.S. Senate at the moment. So why did you focus in on the individuals that you chose?
To some extent, it was arbitrary. I tried to pick high-level people from those three administrations. So I looked at people who were in the governor's office. I looked at people who were secretaries of agencies or deputy secretaries. I looked at oil and gas lobbyists to see if they had a government background. And I really did feel like while I was doing the research that I could do this all day long if I wanted to. There's so much back and forth. There's a lot of back and forth between, you know, rank and file people too that I didn't even get into. But I really view it as a living document that I'd hope to add to. I hope to track these people through their careers. I put my email address in the about section. So I'm hoping people will contact me if they think there's somebody that I've missed or if there's an update that needs to be made. My plan is to just keep an eye on these people, continue to update it and add to it.
Why did you decide to call your project Blurred Lines?
Well, I have to admit, I was somewhat inspired by that Robin Thicke song, Blurred Lines, that was popular a few summers ago. Just for the record, I'm not a fan of the song. The revolving door is the common term you hear. But what I saw is not everybody in here went through a revolution that they went in and out and back again. Some people just went one direction or the other. And what I realized was that when you get up close the lines are blurry when you think about government versus business versus lobbying and environmental groups. Sometimes people think there's a sharp distinction between those, but there really isn't. And when you look at people, whether there's Democrat or Republican, there's a lot of intermingling between whether they advocate for the business community or environmental groups. I think sometimes from far away, it can look like there's these clear lines and clear distinction. But up close, it gets a lot blurrier.
Is there a code of ethics for what you can and can't do after you leave the government?
Yeah, our state ethics law basically bars you from lobbying the government body you are associated with for 1 year after you leave. But it has kind of a loophole, because what government reform groups would like to see is they'd like to see that strengthened. Because, for example, you can work in the governor's office, which, let's face it, you have a great deal of influence in the governor's office. And that means when you leave for 1 year, you cannot lobby the governor's office. But of course, you can lobby the legislature. You can lobby all sorts of other people. Or if you worked in the state house, you can't lobby the house, but you could lobby the Senate or the governor's office. So what government reform groups would like to see is they'd like a 2-year buffer, and they'd like that sort of sphere of influence that you had to be widened so that it's not just the government body you're affiliated with.
Have you found or reported on any policies or decisions in Pennsylvania that favor industry and might have resulted from these blurred lines between the public and private sector?
That's not exactly what I was doing here. I was just trying to showcase the movements in a visual way. But I would like to dig into some of these resumes, because what I did notice at looking through these companies and businesses that people are affiliated with, some of them have gotten sizable state grants, which doesn't necessarily prove anything. But I think you do have to be careful when you're a public official and you have influence over how public money is spent, that, you know, I think the public deserves to have confidence that you're acting in the public interest and you're not just helping yourself when thinking about the next job you might get or helping your friends or business associates. So I do plan to dig into that more. But for now, you know, I'm not accusing anyone here of any specific ethical violations. But I, you know, just wanted to kind of give people a flavor for what's happening.
Have you noticed any other trends in your reporting or as you were putting this together?
I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of times the Corbett administration got criticized for being sort of too close to the gas industry, but it's really worth remembering that it was the Rendell administration that welcomed the industry into the state and touted its economic benefits and leased out hundreds of thousands of acres of public land for drilling, which proved to be quite an unpopular move, and that many of the people who are in the Rendell administration are back in the Wolf administration.
Marie Cusick is with State Impact Pennsylvania, which reports on the Commonwealth's energy economy. A link to their Blurred Lines project is at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Carol Holsapple. This is the Allegheny Front. One spring day, most of the bees in this farmer's hives died. The rest, well, they were never the same.
These bees are not defensive. They're lackadaisical. They haven't put up any honey.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, when beekeepers get stung by the chemical sprayed near their hives, who is to blame and how are they held accountable? Stay tuned as we search for answers with the Bee Team. You know the monarch butterfly, the one with the distinctive orange stained glass pattern. Now it's at the center of a federal lawsuit. Two environmental groups say they intend to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for failing to protect monarchs under the Endangered Species Act. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that another of the butterfly's biggest supporters disagrees.
Tierra Curry grew up in Appalachia and remembers the mountains teeming with big orange and black monarch butterflies. Today, she's senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity and says the number of monarchs has declined more than 80% from the 20-year average.
Back in the mid-1990s, there were nearly a billion monarchs. In the last 2 years, the population has been the two smallest population sizes ever recorded.
Ann Curry says they could easily be wiped out. In 2002, one winter storm killed more monarchs than currently exist.
Because they all go to the mountains of Mexico for the winter and they cluster on these trees in this small area, they're incredibly vulnerable to bad weather. And this year in particular, with El Nino, They're threatened by severe storms and by drought.
Curry's group, along with the Center for Food Safety, petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2014 to list monarchs as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The agency launched a review. It's supposed to take 12 months to decide, but 2015 came and went without a decision, and the environmental groups are suing.
We want to get a legally binding date from the Fish and Wildlife Service when they'll make a decision on whether or not to protect the monarch under the Endangered Species Act.
Georgia Parham is a spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She says monarchs are one of many important species being reviewed for Endangered Species Act listing.
The monarch petition is one of about 500 petitions that we are looking at.
When someone petitions the agency to list a species, Parham says they look at how the species is doing, the threats to it, and how those fit with the listing criteria. And that can take a while. But she says it doesn't mean nothing is being done.
A species doesn't have to be actually listed for other federal agencies to start looking at it and planning for conservation. But with species like the monarch, we're out ahead of that.
She says monarchs already get a lot of attention, in part because people miss seeing this once common beauty in the backyard, and because President Obama prioritized monarchs in his federal pollinator strategy. The government is working with Mexico and Canada, with states and private landowners, to rebuild habitat and plant milkweed, the only food monarch caterpillars eat. They need to restore tens of millions of acres of habitat, according to Chip Taylor. He's an insect ecologist at the University of Kansas, and he's director of Monarch Watch, a nonprofit group working to help monarch recovery.
The federal government does not have enough federal land in the Midwest, even in the upper Midwest, to provide enough habitat on that federal land that would improve monarch butterfly numbers.
Taylor says they need private landowners to get on board to work with the federal government.
We're talking about very conservative areas of the country, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, which are, you know, really important pivotal states for this monarch production.
He thinks listing monarchs under the Endangered Species Act, a top-down approach, would be counterproductive.
I think what we would see here is that milkweed would disappear overnight. Nobody would want to have it on its landscape simply because this would mean regulation. And people don't want regulation.
But Tiara Curry at the Center for Biological Diversity wants a legally binding agreement on protecting monarchs before a new president takes over in Washington.
And it's possible that the next administration might not prioritize endangered species at all. And at that point, it's really important to have a legally binding date for this decision, and the decision could get put off forever.
Curry expects a legal settlement with the Fish and Wildlife Service on when a decision will be made about listing monarchs out of court. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
One of the threats that monarch butterflies face is pesticides, in particular glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, which kills that all-important milkweed plant they need for survival. Pesticides have also been linked in the decimation of another insect, bees. When two beekeepers in Minnesota started losing bees by the thousands, they suspected a pesticide. But which one? As part of the STEM Story Project distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, producer Megan Multeni reports it took a lab full of scientists to find out, just like BCSI.
It's a golden fall day in Scandia, Minnesota, a rural farming community on the banks of the St. Croix River. The fields are full of yellow corn, 6 feet tall and ready to be harvested. It's beautiful in that tidy Midwestern sort of way. But for a pair of beekeepers, this scene suggests something more sinister. To understand why, we'll journey into a state laboratory and explore a lineup of molecules. But first, we have to go back to a Friday afternoon in May.
My name is Pam Arnold. I am one of the managers here at Salt and Pepper Farm. I live here. I've been keeping bees for quite a few years, 13 years.
Pam and her friend Christy Allen have 5 hives each. The spot is ideal for bees, protected by trees, surrounded by flowering goldenrod and clover. But beyond the bounds of the property, it's corn, as far as you can see. On a spring afternoon, Pam was out in her own field chopping buckwheat when she saw a tractor across the road, ready to do the planting. She noticed the winds were blowing toward her property, and she started to get a bad feeling.
So I checked on the beehives within a few hours of the corn being planted. And at that point, there were piles of dead bees in front of each of our hives.
She had seen insects die after corn planting before, but this time was different. The effect on her bees was immediate, and it was, well, dramatic.
Thousands of dying bees, and then behaving oddly, on their backs, flailing their legs, spinning around, trying to clean off their bodies.
So Pam called Christy to tell her what was going on.
Because I had been through this, so I...
Back in 2013, one of Christy's hives got hit with a pesticide called fipronil, used to keep termites away from buildings. By the time she showed up, more than 20,000 bees were already dead. She lost the hive, and she never found out who did it. To Christy, this was not okay. She wanted a way to hold someone accountable, whoever had sprayed the fipronil. So she talked to legislators, she sat in on committee sessions, she lobbied. And 4 months later, there was a new law on the books. It did two things. It made Minnesota the only state in the country to compensate beekeepers if they lost a hive due to someone else's errant spraying. And it created a task force of scientists to investigate these acute pesticide kills. Like a police forensic unit, this team traces the chemical culprit back to its human source. They're the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's bee team.
My name is Jameson Scholler, and I'm an entomologist.
My name is Matt Jorgensen. I'm an agricultural investigator.
And I'm John Peckham. I'm the manager of our inspection enforcement section.
Christy and Pam called the bee team when they found their bees dying. This was on a Friday afternoon. The next Monday, these guys showed up to figure out what happened. And I should say at this point that the Department of Agriculture wouldn't provide me with specifics about Pam or Christy's cases, because they are both still open and under investigation. So any details about what happened next comes from the beekeepers.
Three people came representing the Department of Ag. Each had a slightly different specialty. They asked us some questions.
Have you been treating for varroa mites? What sorts of...
Basically, they want to rule out other possible suspects. To find out what happened, the investigators next gather clues. And bees. Live bees go into jars and onto ice, so any pesticides in their bodies stay preserved. Dead bees get measured by volume, giving a sense for the overall death toll. One cup equals about 1,000 bees, which is the number you need to qualify as an acute kill.
And that's a level that indicates a threshold of damage that the colony may or may not be able to bump back from.
This is probably as good a place as any to talk about colony collapse disorder, or CCD. Most people know bees aren't doing very well and that CCD is largely to blame. But while scientists don't know exactly what causes it, some mix of disease, lack of food, pesticide exposure, parasites, they do know the symptoms. And they look very different from what Pam and Christy saw on that Friday in May. With colony collapse, the bees disappear suddenly. They all leave one day and they don't come back. Which is why when Christy and Pam saw piles of dead bees, they suspected a pesticide. But before the Department of Agriculture could determine a culprit, the sample had to be analyzed.
We're in the second floor pesticide lab.
This is Gary Horvath, the lab manager at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in St. Paul. This is where Pam and Christy's bees came for chemical analysis.
My name is Yoko Johnson. I'm a supervisor for the environmental analysis unit.
In the lab, Yoko grinds up the bees and mixes them with some liquid and salt. Then they get spun around in a centrifuge to extract out any pesticides that might be present into a few drops of clearish liquid. And in this liquid is the answer to the question of what killed Pam and Christy's bees. Now we just need a gas chromatography mass spectrometry machine.
I'm gonna start this.
Yoko turns on a machine that kind of looks like a big white microwave. It starts heating up to 250 degrees. This turns the sample into a gas. A sticky coating on a coil inside the machine separates out all the chemicals in this gas, including any pesticides that might be present. Then, the machine breaks up the different chemicals and weighs them. Each one leaves behind a unique signature. In forensic metaphors, this is our smoking gun.
The mass spectral response, the way it fragments, is like a fingerprint of the chemical you're looking for.
And like running a set of prints against a criminal database, the offending chemical is lined up with the Department of Agriculture's molecular library.
This is the chromatogram.
Yoko points at a computer screen. The monitor shows a series of sharp peaks, some tall, some short.
These peaks represent each substance. You click it, so you can visually see it matches.
So just like that, we can know exactly which chemical is to blame. For Christy and Pam, that chemical was a pesticide called clothianidin. In the U.S., it's sold under the name Poncho 600.
There's certain levels that the EPA considers toxic to bees, and ours was on the lower side, but can still impact them.
Clothianidin belongs to a class of pesticides known as neonicotinoids because of how chemically similar they are to nicotine. They're used in about 95% of U.S. corn and soy crops. Most often, they're incorporated in seed coatings to protect the seed from hungry insects while it's in the ground during the plant's early life. But researchers have found that the pesticide could come off as a dust and drift onto other plants, plants that bees like. This is how Christy and Pam believe their bees brought home the poison that would eventually kill them. Not all of Pam's bees died following the pesticide hit, but she says the ones that lived haven't been the same since.
These bees are not defensive, they're lackadaisical, they haven't put up any honey.
There's another hive too, one that Pam was tending for a friend, providing it with pollen and sugar water. Those bees weren't out foraging on the day of the corn planting, so they actually serve as a kind of control. And that hive? It's doing very well. 3 months after the incident, there isn't yet any closure for either Christy or Pam. For now, their cases remain open. Pesticide investigators like Matt continue to dig through records, interview neighboring farmers, and look at weather logs. Since 2014, when the compensation law was passed, there have been 10 investigations, including Pam and Christie's. No one has yet been compensated. And while it might be poetic for Christy to be the first person to benefit from a law she helped write, she's not holding her breath.
The investigation may or may not be able to prove that I had an acute pesticide poisoning as defined by this compensation law. But it's not about the dollars, it's about the fact that this is the system that we're in. And there's been multiple days this summer where I just, like, I'm banging my head against a beehive and I'm like, why am I doing this? You know, because you can go into a hive and everything looks beautiful and normal, and then the next day it's like, what happened?
Whatever happens with Christy's investigation, it's already become an important data point for her as she tries to make sense of the losses. Lately, a picture has started to emerge. This year, her best hives were across the river in Wisconsin, where it's too hilly for industrial agriculture. The worst ones were in southern Minnesota, surrounded by corn. She admits it may not be strictly scientific, but it's information she'll use next year to try to give her bees their best shot at surviving. But for Pam, moving her bees isn't an option. This is their home, and it's her home too.
The privilege of living in an environment where all of these things are visible to us is counterbalanced by this sort of growing awareness that we're watching it end. Because what's affecting our bees is affecting the birds, is affecting the water. How do we measure the systemic impact of these acute situations?
It's a good question, a complex one that we don't really understand just yet. Lab studies don't do a good job of replicating real life, and causation outside the lab is tricky to prove because it's so uncontrolled. But some answers are beginning to come out. In the summer of 2015, British scientists showed that honeybee die-offs were linked to neonicotinoid seed treatments, the same stuff that Christy and Pam suspect killed their bees. Now, similar studies are underway in the U.S. Bees pollinate 90% of the world's food crops, so if the pesticides we use really are killing them off, bees might not be the only species losing out. I'm Megan Multenny.
Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Carol Holsapple. Join us again here next time, or find us online on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front.
The STEM Story Project is distributed by PRX and is made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.